From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We start the show today by looking at diversity in Milwaukee. Writer Evie Perry shares her research on how it works and how it's challenged in River West.
Then why the diversity of neighborhoods like Sherman Park is an increasingly rare phenomenon in Milwaukee and around the country.
If you look at it long term, in American society especially, many groups have a strong sense of us, and if you have a strong sense of us, you're going to have a strong sense of them. So that kind of almost implies that there will be separation.
And why onlyness is a better predictor than talent as a way to make a difference.
Often when people say someone's talented, they'll often say, oh, it's because someone has credentials or someone has the right academic background or the right brands that they've worked with. And I was trying to say, no, what is that thing that says each and every single one of us has some bit of value to add to the world?
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. In August of 2016, racial tensions bubbled to the surface in Milwaukee. The violence that erupted in Sherman Park following a police shooting put the challenges of Milwaukee's black-white relations front and center for the rest of the country to see.
But as many residents of Sherman Park would urge the country to take a more nuanced view of their neighborhood, writer Evie Perry suggests there's another area that's important to study for how diversity can work.
Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee, but a native of the Milwaukee area and author of the book Live and Let Live, Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood. I spoke with her earlier this summer on stage at Boswell Book Company. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What was your objective as this project coalesced and you and your partner moved to the neighborhood?
I will be honest in saying that, like most ethnographers, I didn't really know what I was getting into. So I had a lot of questions and a place, but those questions changed because the place inevitably changed me. So we are both from here, and though I didn't go to graduate school here, I really, really wanted to come home to do my dissertation research. I love Milwaukee, I feel very invested in Milwaukee, and I feel very worried about Milwaukee, and want to be a part of telling stories about this place that help us move forward. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do that, but my questions were both sort of personal and sociological. So I'd studied a lot about segregation. And a lot of folks had studied a lot about segregation. We knew a lot about segregation and all the bad things that segregation does in terms of exacerbating racial and class tensions, in terms of concentrating poverty, in terms of creating very deep political divides. But we didn't know a lot about integration. So people kind of treated it like this thing to be celebrated, like, of course, integration will solve all of our problems if we can just get people to live together and watch the magic happen. Or they said, you know, there seems to be a lot of conflict and integrated neighborhoods never last and they're sort of lousy, so we need to find another solution. And that seemed to me like a perfect place to step in and say, well, instead of what it can be or what it's failing to be, what is it actually?
Well, and so talk about your methodology. You talk about the personal and you talk about the sociological. Is there a complexity in the intersection of living in a place and also studying it?
Yes, I would say it's full of complexity, which is what makes it work. So I lived in the neighborhood for 3 years, and I just did life in the neighborhood in a sort of classic, heavy, really intense way. So I became really, really embedded in neighborhood life, sought out all different sorts of people to talk to spend time with, to go about their daily rounds with them, to sit on their porches, to go to all sorts of clubs and activities, and again, 36 bars. And I think there's something about doing the life of a neighborhood as a new person that makes you really, really sensitive to the ways in which you are adjusting to a new place and how people deal with it in really different ways from you and different ways from one another. And of course, interviewing people is invaluable. I think you also enjoy interviewing people. And so that was a really wonderful way, and I see some people I interviewed here, for people to really share their journey through this neighborhood, if they were potentially born in it or moved to it, and sort of what it became to them. I think the complexity for me was when I actually had to sit down and write the thing to see patterns and really document those patterns and be very honest about what I saw. and work on not sort of overly romanticizing a place that I had totally fallen in love with.
Well, right. I mean, if doing what you were doing kind of gave you license to be nosy, and I think I know a little something about that phenomenon, what were the kinds of questions that you were asking, and did you see things change over the 3 years that you lived there in terms of how willing people were to share, you know, their warts and all kinds of impressions of the place that they live and love?
So I'll start with change over time. I think I was actually astounded by how willing people were to share warts and all with me from the beginning. And I think I was able, I'd like to believe I was able to build some level of trust that what I was really invested in was understanding how they saw things. Not this perfect picture, even a picture that mattered for anyone else, but just you. How do you, living in this neighborhood, how do you see it? What worries you? What do you love? When do you think about moving, if ever? And I was amazed at people's generosity. I think what changed for me was that the neighborhood became familiar. And so it's funny looking back at my field notes from my early days in the field, the things that shocked me or surprised me, the noises, for example, I couldn't even hear them by the time I left. So I would usually, and this could be an informal interaction or sitting down and interviewing someone, I would always ask people stories. So what is the story of how you came to live in this neighborhood? And again, for some people, it was they were born in the neighborhood. And then I would have them take me through lots of their contrasts, their evaluations, best and worst, things they would love to see, things that have changed, their perceptions have changed, and let their stories lead me into our exploration. And again, always encouraging people to embed their observations in things that actually happen.
Well, and so I feel like this is almost tantamount to asking you to go through your book point by point. But what were the primary sources of tension that you identified, even among people who were, by and large, it seems, very glad to be where they were? What were the points of friction?
So there were smaller frictions and larger frictions. And because I focused so much on life on the block, I was really interested in those everyday kinds of tensions and conflicts. And those were over all sorts of things. Property maintenance, how well did you keep up your house, or how wild is your garden? Noise level, right? So how loud are you? Child rearing. You know, what are the ways in which you're raising your children out in public? Public drinking, substance abuse, leisure activities, what's disruptive, what's okay? Economic activities, what's not legal and okay, what's not legal and okay? These everyday kinds of negotiations. And those tensions, though they sometimes created negative sorts of conflict, sometimes even violence, certainly hurt feelings, I, in the end, came to see as really vital to neighborhood life. That conflict, actually, these little conflicts produced these opportunities to get to know people, to understand what kind of our standards are, as flexible and kind of fluid as they may seem, and to not have one standard for a way to be in a neighborhood that had so many different kinds of people being in so many different kinds of ways. And without that conflict, I feel like the most dominant would win, and they would sort of push down their way of being in the world on the rest. And instead, it was just this sort of beautiful, sometimes ugly, often funny river of negotiation. And I'd like to think that along the way, sometimes people also got a better sense of where someone else was coming from. Because if I'm never going to engage with you about why you're making me so mad, Mitch, I'm not going to learn much about why you do what you do.
One of the conflicts that really stuck with me is this, I think you call it a neighborhood navigation rubric, a very sociological term for a chart. Can you describe the distinction between the ideas of live and let live, which, you know, product placement here, and hold to a higher standard?
So this was one of those larger tensions that I saw playing out in the neighborhood. So live and let live, these folks tended to see the neighborhood as a place that needed to be preserved and protected. So diversity is our strength was an actual mantra that I heard again and again and again. And for them, problems were defined not in a really clear-cut way. So something wasn't problematic because it was illegal. It wasn't problematic because it was in violation of a city code. It was problematic when it did harm. And harm could be addressed on a block-by-block basis, on a neighbor-by-neighbor basis. And so the way that they went about dealing with problems started with talking with the neighbor, right? So that was the approach. And only if things really escalated would they move to something like calling a landlord, calling the Department of Neighborhood Services, calling police. So there was this kind of this slow escalation, personal first. Hold the neighborhood to a higher standard. These are people who are also very deeply invested in the neighborhood, who really cared about River West, and they were really invested in its potential. So they wanted to see it grow and develop. They wanted to see crime drop. They wanted to see smart economic development. You know, sometimes they wanted to see their property values rise, which I think we can understand. And they wanted to hold the neighborhood to a higher standard, and a very clear set of standards, standards that are laid out in what is legal, standards that are laid out in, you know, what is also sort of just mainstream white right, like a version, a cultural version of good. And they, though they sometimes engage neighbors, were much more quick to call police or pull in the authorities and tended to have really strong relationships with people in power and were able to use those to the advantage. So I think these are people who are all invested in the neighborhood, but have very different ways of defining and dealing with problems.
I gather that graffiti is one of those areas where this really sort of comes to a head.
It is indeed. Is graffiti art or is it blight? Does it signal that this is a creative neighborhood full of artists, or does it signal that this is a dangerous neighborhood where we have lost all control? So this was certainly one area where there was a lot of disagreement. And one of the interesting projects some of you may know about is the Art in the Alleys project, where some neat folks in the neighborhood asked muralists to throw up murals on people's garages in the alleys in the neighborhood. And a lot of homeowners agreed, and a lot of artists readily agreed. And some of them looked like graffiti. And this really upset some residents. They thought that somehow there's art, and then this is something else. And I think it's not, if you push that a little bit further, sometimes it's something else is youth, it's crime, and it's black and brown people. This kind of tangle of pathology that is associated with graffiti. And neighborhood folks fought back and forth. When larger issues came up around the city, when a Southside alderman tried to pass something that basically said that you can't put up graffiti on your own property, River Westerners went nuts and let him know just what they thought of that proposed ordinance. But, you know, it's really hard. For some people, they feel like it's sending the wrong signal about the neighborhood. It looks like disorder. And for other people, it looks like a place they value and love.
A lot of people, academics and the rest of us alike, have made the point that we're not always very good at living with difference. After all of your research, do you think the people of River West are any different? Realizing that many of them are in this room?
Yes. Yeah, I think in many ways we, people living in the United States, are not very good at living with difference. And I think a big reason why we are not good at living with difference is because we don't have a lot of good practice. And I think that's particularly true for people with more power, people who have, people who have lots and lots of resources, people who are white. I think it's because of segregation. And so lousy practice or a lack of practice can generate a real lack of skills, I guess. So yes, in some ways I think people in River West have figured out and are constantly in the process of figuring out ways to live with difference. It is not, however, a story that is simple or easy. So one of the things that I learned from people in River West is that it takes work, and it takes work all the time. So if you're really willing to regularly be engaging people and trying to understand them in context, I mean, I think of it as kind of like a practical empathy. And I don't think people necessarily develop it because they want to be good. I think it's a good way to survive in River West and thrive in River West. Is to, for example, pay attention to your neighbors. I mean, there's some River West folks here, I think you know this. If you pay attention to your neighbors, you're gonna make your life easier, your block safer. So there's this shared fate. Sometimes it comes in the form of shared threat that really encourages people to engage and work things out. And I think there are a lot of lessons we have from River Westerners. I think if we look at a lot of diversity initiatives in corporations or universities, they're very much about sort of bringing people in and having people act like us and get with the program. And River West, that doesn't fly. It's subtle, but it's radical. It's, okay, come on in and let's see what mess we can kind of create together.
I think 3 years of work went into this. At the end of those 3 years, what questions did you still have that you don't think you were able to answer?
So many. First, how do we maintain this? So even one of the questions that I was able to, I think, answer to a certain degree is, so how is it that this continues beyond year after year? It's difficult to see how, in the face of continued threats for things like gentrification or decline, and a profound lack of affordable housing, how in particular we'll be able to maintain class diversity. I'm not sure how to do that. And a question that I get a lot is, so how do we create this elsewhere? What does this look like in policy? And if you look at some of the mixed income communities that policy has created, I mean, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, has put tons of money into tearing down concentrated poverty projects and building mixed income communities. And those communities typically do not look anything like River West. Poor people in those communities, the renters and the public housing residents, are heavily policed. They're under a lot of surveillance and generally feel excluded, even though they're integrated, they're excluded. And how do you translate something that is really deeply cultural when you're building it from scratch? So those are some of the questions I'm left with.
Well, and do you feel like, I mean, is it your job as a sociologist and an ethnographer to suggest what to do with what you learned, or do you sort of have to be able to turn this information and these lessons you got loose and let people do with it as they can?
Yes and yes. I do not pretend for a minute to have all or even many of the answers. Although I do think a lot of River Westerners have some great answers, some of whom didn't agree with me at all. I think that it is my responsibility as someone who has been lucky enough to study a place, to share that place, and to really think deeply about how we might translate this into some positive change. I mean, I'm a sociologist because I care deeply about justice, and I am a ridiculous optimist, and actually think that we are capable of creating a more just and equitable society. But I know that I need a team to do that. So I don't pretend, I don't have the hubris to claim that I have the answers. But I also think that it's important to really invest in the scientific project of simply understanding. And absolutely, if you make it accessible enough, which I hope this is, turning it over to people who can make it even better.
Well, and so I feel like this is a loaded question. Milwaukee, for a couple of years, has gotten a national reputation as this segregated place where people just aren't getting along. Do you think there's a counter-narrative that needs to happen to get the message of Milwaukee out to the rest of the country, and does that counter-narrative include River West?
I think we need two sets of counter-narratives. I think we really need some internal counter-narratives. So I listen a lot to the stories that people tell me about their neighborhoods and where they live. I also listen to people tell me about the places they won't go or don't go and why. And I think in Milwaukee, a lot of folks have stories about places they won't go and reasons for why they won't go there that are uncharitable, damaging, wrong, unfair. And I think that if we start taking the time to change our narrow-minded and limited stories about other places in the city, that's a really good start to trying to tell other people about who we are as a different place. So yes, and certainly I think River West is part of that story. Again, it's not like River West is trouble-free. I know there are lots of things that I think are really amazing about it. It has its own challenges. And I think we have a lot to learn from that place. But for starters, you know, think about the places that you drive through and the assumptions you make about what you see. And that was one of the amazing things about River West. What looks like chaos and trash to outsiders is gold sometimes, or at least entertaining to insiders. And then inevitably, I think it will change the ways that we think about and define a good neighborhood. I think that goes right along with the really simplistic stories we tell about good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods, and I dare you to find me one of either of those.
Evie Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee. She is a Milwaukee area native. Her recent book about River West is called Live and Let Live: Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood.
We look at diversity in another Milwaukee neighborhood, Sherman Park, when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this summer, Lake Effect's Mayon Silver filed a series of reports on diversity in Sherman Park. In one story, she introduced us to two adjacent businesses, a barbershop catering to mainly African-American clients, and the kosher butcher and deli next door.
She also reported on just what led Sherman Park to become the diverse place that it is today by speaking with historian John Gerda. He explained to her how these two vastly different traditions ended up sharing a neighborhood.
Starting with the Jewish community, for the Eastern European Jews, the foothold in Milwaukee was the Haymarket area, which is right around the Hillside Terrace housing project, around between 12th and 3rd and maybe Juneau up to about Walnut, that section. And they began there back in the 1880s, and that had been a German neighborhood, and the vectors in Milwaukee are really obvious, and they are in most cities. You kind of begin at the heart of town and move out in very predictable directions. So the Germans moved north and west as they advanced economically, and the Jews followed them. So their foothold is the 1880s. By the turn of the 20th century, they are moving not far, you know, but up to, you know, maybe North Avenue. Teens and 20s is when they really began to move in that direction in large numbers. And then the major movement was through the decade of the 1920s out to Sherman Park, and that's the area between 31st and 60th and North Avenue and Capitol Drive. And Center Street and Burleigh became their main corridors. There were Jewish businesses there, everyone from Guten's Deli to the Sanitary Kosher Market to New Method Hebrew School. And interestingly, although a lot of the people moved out there, the synagogues did not follow largely until after World War II. So you have the war ends in 45. And in the next 15 years, you've got six synagogues locating in, you know, the Sherman Park neighborhood, largely on Center and Burleigh. There had been one a little earlier, but it was not quite in Sherman Park. It was Bethel, which was down in Washington Heights. That goes back to 1923. And that was the first synagogue in Milwaukee, west of 13th Street. So that's kind of where the movement was. So you have, it's a very mixed population. So there were a lot of Germans out there, some Irish, a variety of other European groups, but Jews were, because they had all the institutions, a very visible component of that population. The African-American population was the identical story. They begin even earlier in Milwaukee. They go back to the 1830s. By 1850, there were probably 100 African-Americans in Milwaukee. And in time, their neighborhood became right around the old Haymarket, you know, the old Jewish quarter back west of Schlitz Brewery. And the area a bit north, you know, 3rd Street, the Bronzeville section, 3rd, Walnut, up North Avenue, that becomes, you know, their commercial heart. And just like the Germans first and then the Jews, the African Americans moved north and west on those same vectors, Fond du Lac Avenue, Titonia, Lisbon. And by the 1970s, you know, is when they were a significant presence in Sherman Park. I think in 1980, they were about 26% of Sherman Park's population. So that was kind of a critical mass. And for all three groups, the motivation was the same. You are moving out as you are moving up, looking for a better quality of life for your families.
And why is it that the better quality of life is out? Why was it that, for instance, the Germans originally moved out there and then the Jews followed and then African Americans? Like, what was better about those areas?
Sort of the American way. You kind of, every generation has an expectation of doing better than its parents. And especially for immigrants, you know, their kids, you know, were the ones who were living the American dream, where their parents were kind of living in both worlds in a lot of ways. So, for instance, on the north side, those houses in the Haymarket area, they weren't a whole lot to begin with, and they had not improved with age. So there was a very obvious increase in the standard of living as you moved out to new homes. It's the same thing that motivated people after World War II to move to the suburbs all across the country. You know, your place of your own, new house, new appliances. You know, it's kind of the American dream of advancement, and that was true. That was true for all the groups.
I see. Was the school a major draw in the Sherman Park area?
It was among the major draws. Washington High School opens back in 1915 on Sherman Boulevard, so it was a new school, you know, kind of waiting for you know, critical mass of population, and that became widely considered the best high school in Milwaukee. So that was that became a magnet, but it was by no means the only one. It was this much more generalized pattern of moving out as you move up. Education was part of that, but so was housing, so were businesses, so were the yards. So it was kind of a complex of all those factors.
And were there better jobs out in, like, further out areas like Sherman Park?
No. It was not so much economically driven. By the time Sherman Park really experiences great growth in the 1920s, Milwaukee, like most U.S. cities, had made the transition to a very automobile-oriented culture. Streetcars were still really important, and there were good lines kind of going out in that direction. But a lot of people who built those houses in Sherman Park back in the 1920s were commuting back to work the north side or downtown. In the case of the Jewish population, merchants, professionals, you know, people who were largely white-collar. There were some blue-collar workers, but not as many. For African-Americans, there were a lot of industrial jobs along the 30th Street Industrial Corridor that runs from Miller Brewing down there in Highland all the way up to past A.O. Smith on Capitol Drive. So there were lots and lots of jobs there. And that was also a draw, just as education was. But again, it was that far more generalized pattern of migration out from an old and somewhat weather-beaten part of town out to something new.
And was it the Germans who built those houses out in Sherman Park?
Initially, they were the largest group, but it was kind of mixed European back in the 20s, and Jewish families as well built those homes. You know, so a lot of those were. That was the first pile of sticks on any of those lots. There were those families who moved out there and built, you know, back in the 20s.
And why was it that maybe parts of Sherman Park have deteriorated as time has gone on?
Part of the same pattern. You know, you have deterioration of the very heart of the inner city. You know, partly it's a function of the age of homes. A greater part is a function of income, and that is related to a higher proportion of renter-occupied homes and owner-occupied homes. Landlords, you know, not being as diligent about upkeep as, you know, you would hope them to be. So it's been a complex of sort of the physical issues, and what drives a lot of that is the deindustrialization of a lot of Milwaukee, places like the 30th Street Industrial Corridor, beginning in the 1980s. That was when things really began to change. And that's national. It's not just Milwaukee. We lost about a quarter of our manufacturing jobs between 79 and 83, and a lot of those were held by African Americans. So it was Milwaukee, relatively speaking, suffered a less severe loss of jobs than other cities, but still it was you certainly characterize it as catastrophic. So, you know, without means to keep those houses in good shape, they began to deteriorate even faster. So it was kind of a blend of age and income.
And how has the Jewish community been able to upkeep their homes and that type of thing?
The Orthodox community there, and that's the other pattern. By the 1970s, you have a lot of movement of the original Jewish residents, their descendants by that time, and their congregations, in large part to the area east of the Milwaukee River, so the North Shore especially. And it's really interesting, if you follow the patterns. The first synagogue row in Milwaukee was around Cherry Street, between 3rd and 6th, and the next one out was Center Street in Burleigh, between roughly 31st and 60th, and the next one out was Mequon Road, west of Fort Washington Road. So you have this really very interesting, you know, kind of migration. So there was a movement out of the Orthodox congregations, many of whom became conservative, And the last one remaining there was Beth Yehuda. And one of the real attractions for the people of Beth Yehuda was this wonderful housing stock. You've got these great land and stone brick period revivals, these great bungalows from the 20s. And as the area, it was kind of a mixed blessing, but as the area lost, you know, some of its economic power, those houses were really reasonably priced. So you could get a great house in Sherman Park, a great yard. And these were homes that had been, for the most part, pretty well maintained from the time they were built back in the 1920s, in some cases the 1930s. So how they were able, you know, to preserve that neighborhood was simply to maintain standards that were already there.
And when the Jewish population was there over the decades, did it tend to be an Orthodox Jewish population, or was it a mixed Orthodox secular?
It was largely Orthodox, but what was going on in American society and in American Judaism was kind of this movement away from the strictures of more traditional religions. And early on, you know, there were only two branches. It was Reform, which was the more liberal, and in its early incarnations, more German. And the Eastern Europeans were largely Orthodox. And that was with a small O, and it was the only Judaism they know. And what happened by the teens and 20s, you have the conservative movement entering kind of the middle space between them, you know, sort of between the strictures of tradition and what was felt to be the overly liberal interpretations of Reform. So a lot of congregations that had been Orthodox became conservative. At the same time, there was a movement away among Jews as among Catholics and Protestants in all those neighborhoods, away from strict observance and toward a more secular interpretation of society. So those things were going on at the same time, you know, kind of the loosening of traditional ties to Orthodoxy in the Jews' case, and the more secularization of American society that really became a tidal wave after World War II.
Did the Jewish population mainly attend, did the kids mostly attend Washington High School and the public schools, or were there private Jewish schools?
The Jewish schools were largely value-added. No, there weren't any, until the Yeshiva Elementary School opened, you know, by Beth Yehuda. I don't believe there was a full-time school. You know, Beth Israel had one on Titonia back in the 1920s. But for the most part, it was the synagogue's role and the families, obviously, to make sure there was education about tradition, you know, both cultural and religious. But the main education was done in the public schools.
As far as the status today of the two communities that are living there along with any other communities that are inhabiting Sherman Park, do you think that there's things and lessons we can learn from that, or trends or anything like that?
One of the lessons of Sherman Park, you know, that's been for the last at least generation and more, for going on 50 years at this point, an experiment in diversity. And there still is very impressive diversity there, but I think in 2010, the African-American population was roughly 83% of Sherman Park's population. So it's become, obviously, very much a majority black neighborhood. There are other groups there, including Gentile preservationists who just love those old bungalows and period revival homes. But Beth Yehuda, you know, the Orthodox community there, is something of a village inside the city, and I think that's how they see themselves as well. And they've been, you know, certainly they are a community that you know, has its own very strong sense of internal solidarity, but they've also been involved in the area in and surrounding their community. So I guess if there's a lesson there, the two lessons would be how hard it is to maintain in American society a true diversity for the long term, and another lesson would be that in the case of Sherman Park, you know, you really do have, in this case, Orthodox Jews and African Americans living side by side, generally speaking, in harmony, in that symbiosis.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and author of numerous books, including The Making of Milwaukee and Cream City Chronicles. He first spoke with Mayon Silver in June. You can see pictures and hear all of the parts of her series on Sherman Park at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then author and innovator Nilufer Merchant shares her thoughts on how any one of us can make a dent in the world. Lake Effect returns with that on Milwaukee Public Radio right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The world is awash in ways we can make a difference. But often we are our own worst enemies. We downplay our ideas as silly or impractical, or if we do present them to others, they get shot down and we never bring them up again. Nilufer Merchant wants to change that.
Merchant is an entrepreneur and an innovative business thinker who has launched more than 100 products and has successfully advised companies such as Apple. Her new book is called The Power of Onlyness. It's a series of stories and examples of how people turned not me into yes, let's go, and in the process made a difference in the world. Merchant was in Milwaukee last month, and she stopped by the studio then to explain what she means by onlyness.
I coined the term back in 2011, 2012, and it was a business concept that I was trying to name. I was trying to say value creation shifted from organizations and from capitalization to ideas. Where do ideas come from? They come from that spot only you stand. And so I was characterizing that, but like struggling with, well, how do you name it? And in a distributed world, it would mean that ideas born of different onlys could actually count. And yet I was trying to use words like talent, and talent didn't work. And then words like uniqueness. And I'll tell you why talent didn't work, because it might help. Talent is often, when people say someone's talented, they'll often say, oh, it's because someone has credentials or someone has the right academic background or the right brands that they've worked with. And I was trying to say, no, what is that thing that says each and every single one of us has some bit of value to add to the world? Based on that spot in the world, only they stand. And we kept kind of coming back to that notion of only, and hence this distributedness, right? Connectedness allows you to scale things. So that's the heritage of the word onlyness.
And it is individual, as you say, but you also expanded it into the idea of it being collaborative, too, that there are many onlys that can come together to become greater than the sum of its parts.
Right. I wasn't saying only like more of you, because onlyness could be like that kind of word, right? Could be a hybrid word, which like cats, like the S added to cat is more of cats, you know, kind of thing, the plural. I was trying to say, what is it that you care about based on that spot in the world only you stand in, based on your history and experience, visions and hopes, that then connects you to the world? And so that's the braidedness of the two pieces. Those two belong together.
And you have a lot of examples in the book of how people had this spark of an idea, maybe not even a whole idea yet, but some niggling thing that says, this isn't right and I want to fix it, or I see something that could do something else, but then how they expand that. And how do you see this as different from, say, any other business manual that says, you know, everyone collaborates and works together and, you know, makes a product? How is this different?
Well, I think there's probably three pieces to that. One is, there's a lot of us whose only don't count. We get told, because we don't fit the cultural dominant narrative, we get told that our ideas are marginal and therefore meaningless. Just as an example of that, and I'll click back to those other two pieces. So an example of that was Kimberly Bryant, who wanted to shape the future of technology. She wanted people who look like her to really be an equal member of the tech community. When she was first introduced to her colleagues at first sort of major engineering job she had, her boss introduced her not by Kimberly Bryant and here, the passion she has, or Kimberly Bryant and the unique skills she brings, but Kimberly Bryant, with her, we got a twofer. And what her boss was pointing out was that Kimberly is a Black woman in tech. And so he was basically characterizing her otherness, not her onlyness. Right? That thing that would allow her to contribute that which only she could bring and actually allow her to build on our ideas. So for those of us whose only have been marginalized, the first step in this process is to claim your only even when someone else has deemed it not valuable.
Which can be so difficult to do.
Oh my gosh. It's the most, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to people they make it like they look back at me like, gosh, that seems pretty normal. And I said, yeah, it's both the most ordinary idea in the world and the most revolutionary idea in the world at the same time, depending on who you are. Right. And it just the difference is that there's 30 to 40% of a population that fit the dominant cultural narrative that is told in America that is mostly white, heterosexual males. So for the rest of us, we get to leave our ideas mostly at the door because we're told messages, right, that we have to overcome in order for us to be able to claim our ideas. The statistic that really struck me, though, to show how big of a problem this is, though, so one of the pieces of research I found was that 61%, and this is a U.S. statistic, of the U.S. population conforms or fits in to the dominant narrative. So they basically, the word that the researcher used was, do you cover? So this was self-recognized covering. And the examples were like the guy who didn't want to talk about his kids at work because he was afraid his colleagues would think he didn't care and wasn't committed to his job. And so he found himself covering his own passions and interests about being a good dad and having an equal responsibility as a family man and sort of focused on other things. And there were tons of other examples. And the 61% number didn't shock me, but I'll tell you what did. A whopping 45% of single white men cover. And what that shows us is how significant this covering thing is. And the implication is when we're not showing up fully alive in the places we work, in our communities, even in our own lives, what it means is we're not showing up with our ideas. And that little bit, or maybe big bit, that we could add to the world because we're figuring out a way just to hide, right? And how to fit in. And fitting in is the greatest cost to our own ideas.
But yet, one of the things that was a sort of a theme through the examples that you wrote about in the book is that innovation, coming up with or allowing these new ideas to blossom, oftentimes it gets stifled because I think as a species, we tend to want to go to the familiar. We are creatures of habit. Even when it's not a good habit, we tend not to want to break away from it. So the innovation sort of withers on the vine. And so how does onlyness and embracing that help us get past that hurdle?
Well, it goes back to the three things I was going to say, and then I distracted myself by telling a story. But you've just helped me kind of clue back in. So the first piece is to claim, which we just kind of talked about with Kim, really choosing to claim that part of the story that was hers. And by the way, Kim's gone on to train 10,000 black girls to code by starting a program. And she named it Black Girls Code, partly to claim back that story that was hers and to say, no, even if other people in society say this is not important or marginal in some way, for her it was meaningful. The second piece is to figure out, how do you find the other people like you? And whatever that little sliver of interest is, now you can, but it means you have to know how to signal your own interests and to seek the other people out, and then how to even have a common framework, how to have those other people you can count on. So that piece of finding, you know, it's so overused and yet such a deep insight about how do you find your people, not just based on heritage or socioeconomic education or all those other things, but based on what you're passionate about.
And I think everyone would say, well, I don't know. You know, sometimes you just fall into them. You're lucky, you meet. But this sounds way more intentional than that. This is actively seeking those people.
It is. And I was fascinated by the story of Alex Hillman when I found it, because Alex was a young man in, where was he, Philadelphia, and was working at a web design firm during the day. And as he described it to me, sort of sitting over his computer hunched over it, eating Chinese takeout every night because he was so deeply lonely and he missed having a group of people who he called, you know, creative maker types. And everywhere he would go in Philadelphia, he would say, gosh, I can't seem to spot anyone like me. And they seem sort of older and more traditional, and even the tech community seems sort of dated. So he was going to leave. And at one point, the job he was going to leave to in Silicon Valley ends up falling apart. And he kind of thinks, I love Philadelphia, though. I love the spirit of it. I might just try one more time to find my people. And this was really a fun little part of the vignette. He says, and I changed what I wore to the next event. And he changed from wearing suits to these events to wearing these ironic T-shirts that he loved and flannel sort of sweatshirts over it. And then he basically looked for someone who was as geeky as him. And his only goal at that one event was to find one person. Then he went out and asked that person out to beer. Then the next event, he tried to find the next person. And after a while, he started gathering those people together. So it was super intentional. And digitally, he was actually searching them out, like on LinkedIn, and figuring out, like, did they match the profile of, you know, what he was looking for, until he finally started gathering all these people together in coffee shops every Friday, these geeky developers. And finally, first of all, he didn't feel alone. But it turns out that this thing that he thought he was the only one, he ended up finding a whole tribe of them. And they ended up building a co-working space together that's called Indie Hall in Philadelphia. 300 people now co-work together in this space. And when I talked to the deputy mayor of Philadelphia and I said, you know, what did this mean for you? And he said, you know, we always wanted to be an entrepreneurial hub, but we could never find those people. And what Alex and then his crew of people did was basically self-organize. And now all of a sudden the city could figure out how to serve these entrepreneurs better. And so there's this weird thing about when you find your people, you think they're invisible, but it's you signaling what you care about. And that's why the shirt changing thing was so interesting, right? Like, because he's almost rolling up his sleeves and showing his tats in that process. And then signaling, like, here's who I am, world. Who are you back? And then intentionally finding the people who had similar passions and therefore could ultimately end up doing something with that.
You talk a lot about people discovering that they're asking the wrong question and being willing to say, whoa, I thought it was about this, but it's really about this. And being able to then take steps. And it sounds like if you have your tribe together, that if you discover you've asked the wrong question or series of questions, it's more easy to shift. Because institutions aren't known for being able to shift quickly.
That's true. And this has actually been the work I've been doing for the last 20-some years, right, is I've been figuring out how to do organizational transformation. And so what's funny now in looking at this set of stories, because now I'm focusing on the individual ideas out and less organization down, I'm sitting here going, okay, what is it that derives real change from the organic level out? And this thing that you're pointing out, which is about how you change the framework by which we hold something as true, is a way in which you can actually create change. Franklin Leonard was my favorite story out of the book. In that example, Franklin is a young man who ends up showing up in Hollywood basically as a grunt after working at McKinsey and a couple other places, and mostly just because he loved movies. And he's like, oh, I'm going to join this industry and I'll figure it out. And the first year is brutal because he can't find any scripts he likes, and yet that's one of his jobs, is to find scripts. So he sends out a note to everyone he's met, and he asks them three questions. And he says, tell me a script that you love that hasn't been put into production that you've seen in the last year. And he says, in return, I will cross-tabulate all this stuff, because he's a former McKinsey guy, cross-tabulate all this stuff and produce it back to you. That's my give. Do this by Friday and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up creating an alias so people don't even know it's him. And he gets all the stuff back, prints out the five scripts he's most interested in, goes on vacation. 2 weeks later, this was the days when we could actually escape our digital life. And he comes back and his email is full of people forwarding him this master list that he had created, saying, this is so cool. And he's telling me the story. And I said, well, you know, Franklin, what did you think you did different? Like, what do you think really caused it to succeed? And he said, oh, I did this and did that. And I don't really think that's it. And this is me kind of giving him feedback, right? And the more I looked at stories that were parallel to him, because I studied 300 stories in order to pick the final 20 that made it in the book, and I thought it was actually quite different. It was that he asked an original question. So he asked, and he asked it so fast even that I think you can skip past it. He asked, what movie do you love? What script do you love? And if you think about how Hollywood was actually sorting at the time, they were sorting by how did this make money?
I think they still do, probably.
Well, and so it turns out the Blacklist has deeply informed how Hollywood sorts scripts. So that's the organization that he's built. And in fact, I think it was something like 300 of the top films that were produced in terms of just revenue, something like 75% of them were first on the Blacklist. So these are films that were in the dustbin that are basically resurrected by people who say, no, 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 this is an idea worth paying attention to. But what was so fascinating was this tilt of frame, going back to the original question of any industry, right? Healthcare, for example, is an industry that's premised on care, but doesn't always achieve that. Education, driven by learning, doesn't always achieve that. So how do you originally go back to the original question of, what are we here to do? And how do you reframe that question together in such a way that you can start to create change? And I would say every person did that by having a new lens and by holding on to that lens both tightly enough and loosely enough that they were able to create the change. Tightly enough meaning they never lost their original vision, but loosely enough so that a whole bunch of people could hold that idea as their own. So, in fact, as you and I are here, I'm opening my hand and closing my hand to show this visual. So, if we hold an idea so tightly that no one else can pick it up from our fist, it can never become theirs. It's only yours to own. And so I often think about how do you hold an idea in such a way that you're almost proposing it to the world, like, world, come and pick it up with me. And so you're definitely putting it out there, but you're trying to create a space for it in such a way that other people can also come build it into something much bigger.
Well, that kind of takes me to my last question. We could keep talking for days about this, and it's fantastic. But you used a particular word, and it's actually right in the subtitle of your book, about making a dent.
Hmm.
What is it about dent as opposed to taking over the entire world? Why is a dent important?
It's so funny you asked that question because so many people didn't like it when people would hear me describe the subtitle, make your wild ideas mighty enough to dent the world. Like, oh, I don't like the word dent.
Sounds like a mistake.
It does, mm-hmm. Right? But I think about it as almost reshaping the world. You don't reshape the world in this big thing. You kind of like almost little by little. And so the picture that comes to mind is like a copper molder kind of shaping a pot, of little by little shaping the world into what it needs to be. I feel like sometimes we go for these big things. And in fact, you know, the 20 stories I did choose really accomplished tectonically wonderful things, and yet they're relatively unknown players. If I could characterize them this way, ordinary people doing extraordinary things, not because they thought it was such a big idea at the beginning, but because they gave themselves permission to change the littlest thing that they saw. And I feel like that's the way we're going to actually create change from now on, is not by saying, oh, gargantuan, tectonic thing. It's like, what do you see that needs fixing? Go fix that. And this is how we'll imprint ourselves into the world, even if it's small. That's good.
So don't be afraid to make mistakes, and don't be afraid to make a dent.
And to start.
Nilufer Merchant, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Author Nilufer Merchant is a leading business thinker and innovator. Her latest book is The Power of Onlyness: Make Your Wild Ideas Mighty Enough to Dent the World. She was in Milwaukee in August to speak at a 1-800-CEO-READ event and stopped by the studio then. And that's all for the Monday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.